Okay, it's an exciting day because we're welcoming brand new author to the Siren Radio Studios. She's actually not so brand new, but she is as far as we're concerned. It's the fabulous Abigail Tartalin. How are you, Abigail?
I'm very well, thank you, Alex.
I have been privileged, and I use that word quite deliberately, to actually look at the classic Dead Girls. I've read the whole thing, your latest and third novel, and an extraordinary tale of the 11-year-old wonder that is Thera.
Thera Wilde, yes. Mm. She's a little scary for an 11-year-old, but we like her spirit.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the actual theme that comes across there, in any book that actually features pop culture reference that connects Peter Levy, Lord save him, from the joys of Look North in the BBC, right the way through Cyber Pets and a whole heap of other things, can't be bad at all, really, from that point of view. Share with us the tale of Thera as she actually goes through this process of suddenly seeing dogs, being manifested as dead girls, having a very scary experience, and then actually becoming almost the British young child equivalent of the Punisher.
Well, I really like what I'd call feminist revenge narratives, like Hannah and Hard Candy. Hannah with, I don't know how you say it, Saoirse Ronan or Saoirse Ronan?
Saoirse.
Saoirse. There we go.
It's easy. S-A-I-O-R-S-E. It's obviously pronounced Saoirse.
Sure, yeah. I'll go with that. Well, I really enjoy them, and I think it's really refreshing to talk about feminism and women essentially being victimized, but in a kind of a positive way and a bit of a gung-ho, I want to cheer them on. It feels a bit more like watching Star Wars than it does watching a very depressing independent film about women being victimized. So in the book, it actually stems from quite a dark topic. It's talking about missing girls. And Thera grows up with her best friend Billy in 1999, they're 11 years old, and they live in the countryside in Lincolnshire, although I have changed some of the names and some of the place names. And Billy goes missing, and Thera decides that as her best friend, it's a time of girl power, and she's the best one to go out and find her, and she's not scared, so she tries to find Billy. And unfortunately, she finds her, and Billy's been killed, and she's in a wood. And as adults, we kind of know what that means, but Thera doesn't. And I think that we don't really talk to little children that well about what can happen to them and why we say don't talk to strangers and don't go off on your own. And so Thera, being very intelligent and imaginative, sort of makes her own narrative and decides that she'll go and find out who could have killed Billy and why. And then again, because she's a child and her morality is very black and white and she has quite a overactive imagination, she decides that she will avenge her death because there's nothing else to do but to avenge her death.
If you're best friends forever, what else can you actually
exactly.
do?
Exactly.
It's set probably at the end of the 20th century, early 21st century. We haven't gone into social media. That's certainly not around. The notion of Snapchat or indeed other social networks are definitely away from the whole process. I was struck actually between Dead Girls and certain elements that came out of Alex Marwood's The Wicked Girls. I don't know if you've come across
The
Wicked Girls.
That's really interesting. You know, I've not read it, but I did a festival with Alex Marwood not long ago, and that the idea of that book really intrigued me.
From the perspective, again, of the reader's sympathy, from the way in which I kind of... Actually, I think I was always on Thera's side, but there's just a few moments towards the end where you sort of think, oh, is that the right way forward? But yet, written as you have written it basically from Thera's point of view, you're writing it from the perspective of an 11-year-old adolescent child, pre-adolescent child in many ways. She's at the end of junior school. She's going forward to senior school and so on. And again, that notion of how she is prevented from seeing the harshness of the world. I mean, we often hear great tales we have over the last 20, 30 years about how if you watch the news, it can depress you. So if you're a child, it can scare you, it can frighten you, it can do all sorts of things from that perspective. But again, you play around with a lot of those sort of aspects in a way which I found quite fascinating and really kind of, it repays repeated reading. I mean, I basically read the text over a weekend, but it's worth, you know, it's worthwhile diving into it because, you know, there's a lot of really fascinating tropes, I think, you've put into place.
Thank you. Well, I mean, two things there. It was suggested that it would be quite controversial to have a child talking about these kind of issues, but it's relevant to them. If it's relevant to anyone. And so I was very interested to see how a little girl might think through this kind of topic. Secondly, I always have an audience in mind for a book, but it's not necessarily an audience my publisher would be as excited by. But I grew up at a time when I feel like a lot of little girls were going missing. It seemed like every year, it always seemed to be around the summer, somebody would go missing. And a lot of those cases happened in the countryside or happened on holiday in a resort that I would be quite familiar with, that kind of environment. And I had a best friend when I was growing up in primary school that I was really close with. And there was a case where two little girls who were best friends went missing. And I just think it could have been us, and they should be here and we're here. And I decided that I'd like to write something for those girls. And given that they died when they were children, I really wanted to write something that wouldn't be depressing or cast them as victims or display them as angels, because I think there's quite a an unfortunate thing we do when little girls die. We sort of purify them and purify their existence.
Canonize them before they're ready.
Canonize them. That's exactly
it's what
the
happened
word.
In Lourdes with Saint Bernadette, of course. But there we are. That's another line entirely. We're going to talk a lot more as the program proceeds, and we'll hopefully be joined by some of our regular correspondents. People wondering, Anna Lewis doesn't seem to be contactable in Isleworth. What the hey? Likewise, William Coles. But we'll find out about how the text develops and a whole heap of other things. We've kind of selected some of the music, which hopefully can be used as a bit of a soundtrack to maybe read. Bad Girls too. We'll also talk about possible cross-media packages as well. All this over the next over the course of the next, I'd say an hour and 50-odd minutes, basically. Lily Allen, first up, Somewhere Only We Know.
So tell me when you're gonna let
to begin. And if you have a minute, why don't we go talk about it somewhere only we know? 'Cause this could be the end of everything. So why don't we go somewhere only we know?
Of course, and the moral of the story is actually don't ever go and follow a stranger. Who knows what could happen? Actually, you know, stay away from wooded copses in the summer, clearly. Even if you and stay away from Ouija boards. That was the other message that was coming across for me, really. That other line where you think, I don't know where we're going there, because you take us off on that whole journey, Abigail, about is it going to be a young adult, Buffy the Vampire Slayer-esque kind of element that's coming through in this sort of zone worlds beyond? And yet, on the other hand, there's the duality in terms of, from the reader's perspective, is Thera simply making it all up herself?
Well, you've just named my favourite show there. I really did grow up on Buffy, and I think we all need a kind of kick-ass role model like that in our lives.
Well, exactly. Abigail Tarstlin, ace author and indeed writer and creator of Dead Girls. Clearly, if you want a kick-ass individual with respect to public relations, you go no further than Kat. Isn't that right, Kat?
Oh, absolutely, Alex. Wonderful to be on the show. Hello, how are you?
We're very well indeed. And I have to say, and I know you're so busy, I say, yeah, all these public relations materials to actually work through, but Dead Girls by our studio guest today, Abigail Tarstlin, well worth accessing. It's extraordinary text. In the words of our other good friend, Matt Haig, Tarstlin is a natural storyteller.
Wonderful. Oh, it's amazing. It's incredible to listen to the story here, Abigail. It sounds an absolutely wonderful book, and I think it's something that everybody can relate to, especially females who have gone through that process of adolescence and seen things in the media where people have died, as you said, young people seem to be going missing every year at one point, didn't they? And I can totally relate to it.
I think it really does affect women as we, and that's what the book's about, this kind of movement from girlhood to womanhood, and Thera's waking up to how some people do view women and how some people view them as ownable and claimable. So it's a really interesting topic to explore.
It is, and you know, I actually have personal experience of this because I, at the time I was growing up and I was about 13, somebody in our school actually went missing, and it's a very, very tragic story. I won't go into obviously details around that, but, you know, with the Soham murders, etc., I'm sure that you were around at that time when they were going on in the media. And I thought what was interesting there, not only just the subject matter that you're covering, which is actually quite a brave subject, but what you said there was great from my PR perspective, saying that actually the media sometimes sanctify girls who go missing and young people generally who go missing. And that was an interesting element to explore. And is that something that you actually look at in the book, or is that just a personal opinion that you have?
Yeah, I was really interested in how we talk about, for instance, prostitutes who go missing under the same circumstances versus little girls. And I think there's a racial element and an age element, and the idea of women being innocent or experienced, and that a woman's value or a girl's value is greater the purer she is. And so it's not something I like to, when I'm thinking around an issue, I don't like to tackle it kind of head on and be too obvious about it. But in the book, Thera, the protagonist, and indeed all the little girls, are very nuanced characters, I'd like to think, and I portray them as human. And in fact, Thera does say at the memorial of Billy, the character who dies, that Billy wasn't an angel. She was my friend. She was a full human being with her own life, and she didn't deserve to die.
That's really interesting, isn't it? And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, bringing in the two different elements there of young people, young girls being sort of portrayed as angels by the media. And then, as you say there, with prostitutes who've gone missing, that actually they're demonised in a way, aren't they, sometimes? It's felt like it's their own fault because they're putting themselves out there and they're available.
Exactly. And we think that, well, it's not the little girl's fault because they would have never had those kind of feelings. And I think if we do portray them as, for instance, a 13-year-old girl, that's somebody who is already developing a sexuality, and it doesn't, you know, make her less valuable, or, and it doesn't mean it's her fault if something goes wrong. So I think it's quite scary how this subject's written about in the media, and we do devalue women based on their experience and lack of sexual purity.
Later on in the production. Yeah. Sorry, Kat, just talking across the moment. Later on, we'll be talking with Phil Leonis over in Los Angeles. I know Phil's very concerned about toxic masculinity and the whole issues relating to that. Resident of Hackney, karaoke, Netflix, tea, learning languages, women-fronted rock bands, and kick-ass female characters. Just some of the aspects there. I'm thinking in many ways, Kat, if Abigail required a public relations guru, I mean, this is the ideal character for you, isn't it, Kat?
Oh, it is, absolutely. I mean, I think it's fascinating, this whole aspect of femininity and how it's portrayed in the media. And what was quite interesting today, I was reading a story about the Bank of England and the Deputy Governor saying there about the UK economy is entering a menopausal era. And of course, lots of feminists have been up in arms about that because it portrays women as being past their sell-by date when they get to the menopause. It's the other end of the spectrum, in a way, isn't it, from the young prepubescent that Abigail's talking about there and being seen as the angel through to, you know, past your sell-by date when you get to the menopause. And this whole aspect of how women are portrayed generally, and probably not just women, but men, and how they're expected to behave. There is a responsibility that the media have, and you wonder whether or not actually they're stepping up to the mark on that.
Interesting lines and a whole range of aspects there. I mean, the key thing is at least develop debate, develop discussion, work through the process of how things are going, and hopefully sort of allow development from that point of view to work through. He says, actually, this means nothing at all. You know? I'm just looking at the first choice of music that actually Abigail's put forward. And if you'd be kind enough to stay with us, Kat, because we want to talk a bit more about what you're doing in terms of public relations and the whole aspect of various other elements from that perspective. And all this will be coming up after Katy Perry and Raw. suppose technically, Kat, it would be more of a meow from your own perspective, but just a thought there. But then Katy Perry singing "You're Gonna Hear Me Meow," it's not quite, it doesn't have the power, I don't think, really. I think "raw" is the best way forward from that point of view. Excellent stuff.
It is.
We'll do the social media networking stuff, because normally when Kat's actually in the studio, she's a phenomenon. She's a force of nature when it comes to actually getting her shots and images and all sorts of things from that perspective. One of these days, phenomenal. But Abigail, how can people follow you via Twitter?
Kat, I could really use some tips.
Possibly at AJKARTTELIN.
It's AJK Tartellin. Yeah, those are my initials. It doesn't, on Twitter, they don't allow you to have a name as long as mine. So on Instagram, it's Abigail_Tartellin_, but Twitter, it's my initials.
And you are clearly an Instagram soul, which is very important to actually work through that. And you can also access, obviously, Siren Radio at Siren FM, and indeed at Southside Broad Sea, because again, Southside Broadcasting, too long. So Southside Broad Sea. just important that we actually work through that. Kat, share with us what you're up to in currently with respect to public relations and the whole aspect of that, because you remember the CIPR, you've done a whole range of other factors. What other things are developing? Because you're based, I believe, in Peterborough.
Yeah, that's right, not very far from there at all. And just the other side of the border of Lincolnshire, so round about there. But there's lots going on at the moment in PR. And interestingly, what you were saying there about the book, and we were having a discussion there, Abigail, on Abigail's book about the media and how they're portraying women and indeed men. I'm actually working on a big campaign at the moment regarding mental health. And of course, Mental Health Awareness Week this week. And it's interesting that link between media and how people are portrayed and, in fact, the impact on mental health. And that's quite an interesting concept, really, about how everybody has a responsibility to look after one another, including those institutions like the media and different businesses. And so I'm working with a client at the moment, just investigating some potential working together, collaborative approach, really, to mental health. And so I'm doing quite a lot of work on that. But the good thing with that is it's actually regarding mental health being a pre-existing medical condition, because my client's actually an insurance client, and a lot of people don't appreciate that actually anything that you've had in terms of physical and indeed mental health does in fact become a pre-existing condition that can affect insurance. So we're looking at maybe raising awareness of that particular issue going forward as well. And that's quite interesting that you were just saying there about what's been going on in the media and the responsibilities.
Well, interesting enough, tomorrow morning on the breakfast programme, Midweek Drive Morning Edition, we've got Isabel Goldie, Director of Development and Delivery at the Mental Health Foundation, and writer, talking about some shocking facts, actually, which suggests that 60% of young people aged 18 to 24 have felt so stressed by pressure to succeed that they felt overwhelmed or unable to cope. And nearly 4 in 10 young people also said they'd experienced suicidal feelings because of stress, with a further 29% saying that they self-harmed because of it. That is unacceptable. It's not suitable in the 21st century. And
that's quite shocking, actually, Alex, isn't it? And I mean, I do have a lot of friends, actually, who have been through very different situations which have affected their mental health. And I know that there's quite a lot of, promotion out there about get help, go through your GP, go to various different charities to actually help with your mental health. But just personally, and with a very close friend recently, we've just discovered that actually that's not quite as easy as it is first portrayed. And that's a bit upsetting, really, because it is, when you're saying facts like that, Alex, you know, with young people as well as, you know, adults, and you can't access help, you can't access help, you can't access support, where do you turn to? And it's a shocking fact that it's first of all happening in society at all various different levels, but also how do you actually get out of that situation once you're in it? And that's quite upsetting, isn't it?
And returning briefly to Dead Girls, there is an area where I think for certain periods of the text, you're beginning, or the reader is left with the impression that Thera, is she might be suffering from mental health issues herself, really, in terms of where she's working through.
There's certainly a mental health angle in the character's development in Dead Girls. And Kat, as I was saying, what happens in Dead Girls is that one 11-year-old girl finds her best friend who's been killed. And this really impacts her entire community of 11-year-old friends, including a young boy called Nathan. And for me, the mental health aspect is about how it affects their identity and their burgeoning sexuality and how they feel about themselves. And there's a scene in the book where the girls discuss who will be taken next, and which is what they're all scared of. And they talk about the idea that Billy was taken because she was pretty, and how pretty are they? And then they start to compare each other's prettiness and how each other looks. And that's to do as well with the media portrayal and the adults' portrayal of this crime happening because this girl was prettier than the others. And so,
wow.
And there's this, as we go through the book, because Thera is really left to her own devices and doesn't see a counsellor and doesn't talk to her parents much about what's going on, she understands that if a man did this crime, then all men are evil. And she starts to get a really dark idea of what life is and what the real world is like. And obviously, this happening at the age of 11, it almost normalizes the idea of murder for her. And because she's too young to really deal with these things, she comes to it sort of in this superhero versus supervillain type of situation, where she thinks, well, there's a bad guy, he's killed my friend, and so I must find him and kill him too.
Yeah, that's incredible, really, isn't it? If you think about the impact that has on young people, and obviously the enormity of the crime in the first instance, but actually, as you say, it's the aftermath of that, isn't it, which is, you know, how do people react to that? What do people start discussing around it? You know, what is the purpose of it? And they start to try and actually think about why has that happened. And when you start to add in that media element of actually how young girls are portrayed and how women are portrayed, then that I can understand why you brought in that, how attractive they are and how pretty they are. Does that make them more vulnerable? Does that mean they've been chosen? Is that a good thing, a bad thing? And then actually people are comparing. And at that vulnerable age, where they've already gone through an enormous upheaval of something and such so tragic as that, it actually compounds, doesn't it, the issues that they're facing.
Yeah, and I mean, as a... you know, you say with the media, the book is set in 1999, because I just couldn't imagine what it would be like to be an 11-year-old with a mobile phone where you can access absolutely everything. And also an 11-year-old who their parents know where they are all the time. That certainly wasn't the case when I was growing up.
There's a wonderful description in the book, Abigail, where Thera actually goes down to watch, shall we say, some adult television. And there's the one phrase which I thought was just fascinating, when she's actually looking at the screen and it's just, just summed up the whole thing.
Yeah, you used to be able to have to put that information together on your own from very small snippets.
There we are,
snippets of Sex and the City. And now everybody has everything at their fingertips. And I think one of the reasons that the media has such an effect on mental health is that in order to sell us something, and in order to get on air or compete with other magazines, compete with other television shows, you have to appeal to a large audience. And so it's kind of like a lowest common denominator audience. And so you start gender stereotyping, because you can say, okay, these people aren't people anymore. They're a pool of consumers. And what do they all have in common? And a lot of people have in common that they're either men or women. So it's something that I think a lot of people use to target the information that they put out in order to get you to engage with their product.
Yes, absolutely. And advertising has an enormous impact, doesn't it? It has a mass media channel of distribution in the first place, which you're talking about there. But when you're actually talking about the creative content as well, and this is where it becomes dangerous, is that you have that the digital age now allows us to Photoshop and manipulate images beyond, way beyond the normality and into a world that is actually a fantasy world. And then that becomes, A, something that people can't aspire to, and young girls particularly and women are fighting all the time against that stereotypical images of sexuality. But also the fact that actually when you're using that within advertising, you're going beyond the point of responsibility because you're actually selling something that does not exist. And then you've got to start to question the morality of doing that, both on terms of advertising and what it's actually doing in terms of trying to get people to buy something, but secondly, the impact it's having on people out there in terms of their mental health. Fascinating subject.
Kat, stay with us because I know actually we're going to change tack slightly now because I appreciate that back in the day when you were working on another show with us and doing a whole range of other sort of elements within the whole field, the likelihood of us actually seriously discussing the winner of Eurovision would have been deemed insane. And I think we know why. We know the response that would have been given from that point of view. Well, without rushing up to grab the microphone and say, fascists, British fascists, no, we'll stay away from that. Siri managed to work through that. I think it's time we actually played the winner of the Eurovision Song Contest 2018. Did you catch this, Abigail, by any chance?
I didn't at all. You're about to surprise me.
Well, surprise being one word for it. I mean, Kat, are you familiar with Netta, the winner from Israel, with Toy?
I'd like to say, I'm ashamed to say no, but actually I'm celebrating because I don't know it. It's going to be a first for me as well.
Well, bearing in mind that this is singularly responsible now for the 2019 Eurovision Song Contest being held in Israel, probably again in Jerusalem, which I'm sure Donald Trump would be delighted at, this is the winner. And it's all about positive female images. So we're told, then again, just listen to the chicken sounds.
Not your toy, not your toy, not your toy.
and I think it's fair to say it's unlikely to be featured in future editions of Sound and Next Vision. You never know, though. You never know. It's just a thought. The words of Abigail Tartalin, wow, when she saw the video.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it's a bit like Shakira. I can understand the catchiness. I'm not sure quite what's going on with the sort of command post that she's got or what happens when she presses those
she's
buttons.
Not your toy.
Let's hope it's nothing big.
Well, I don't think North Korea have got anything to do with the Eurovision Song Contest, but then people said the same thing about Australia. Yeah. After all, they entered.
Yeah. And what were those waving cats about? I mean, that's a
strange
sort of Asiatic
in many ways,
reference,
isn't
it?
As we said last week, if you want to find out about cultural politics in Europe, Eurovision is the go-to place. Doubtless, Kat, you'll be checking out YouTube videos just to sort of listen to the joys of Thai with Netta. And others,
you know,
as well.
I will. Yeah. Look, I do, in fact, like a bit of Eurovision, and I had it on in the background. I was actually out with some friends and family, and it was in the background. I caught a bit of it, but I wasn't watching it intently like you do, Alex. So I wasn't able to say.
I like to decode the narrative tropes there. You know, and I feel after sort of, you know, I was halfway through Dead Girls, and I thought I need to actually just check what's being said here. It's, you know, what's the message? And sadly, my prediction of Britain's entry finishing 12th, miserably off base there. We finished 22nd or 23rd, I believe.
We are not popular.
That message came across. Yeah, that's the message came across. Never mind. Kat, any final questions you'd like to put to Abigail about life, the universe and various other bits and pieces at this stage before we go and check out Mike Hall, who's going to be performing with his band After Midnight and celebrating the fantastic work of Eric Clapton?
Yeah, I'd just like to know when Dead Girls is out, because is that available now to buy?
Computer now and purchase it. It's online, exactly.
It did. It came out 2 weeks ago, Kat.
Terrific.
And I've had a really good time over the last couple of weeks talking about it on radio mainly. There are so many different interesting themes that people have picked up on, talking about child safety now compared to the 90s, and we've been talking about victim or victor writing female narratives, so it's all been like really fun, and it's out now in hardback, audiobook, Kindle, etc. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. Good luck with it, Abigail. It's
thank
absolutely
you.
And Kat, we need to put those last two questions to you. And without any midweek drive-outs, it falls to me to actually throw them your way. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
It has been absolutely amazing, Alex. Yeah. Wonderful.
Well, it was nice that Jodie Orton, without whom, of course, Abigail would not be in the studio at present, actually, said she's had 7 years of relatively interesting chats, which is nice. That's okay. So I take it then, Kat, you'll be able to join us again in the not-too-distant future.
My arm, I think I'll be there.
Well, we're not into physical violence, as you're well aware, Kat. Just a point there, just want to be quite clear at this particular stage. Here's Eric. I feel wonderful tonight. I feel wonderful.
sweeter bed. And then I tell her, as I turn out the light, I say, my darling, you are wonderful tonight. Oh, my darling, you are wonderful tonight.
Wonderful. And it will be wonderful tonight should you actually check out the joys of Middlesbrough Theatre. Yes, I know it's 130-odd miles away from Lincoln, but it's worthwhile just to actually hear the joys of After Midnight with Mike Hall and a whole range of Eric Clapton classic numbers. Mike, welcome back to the Midweek Drive. How are you, sir?
Fine, thank you. Lovely to speak to you again.
Well, likewise. Actually, talking about social media, it's interesting that I had a message from Mike saying, is he still alive? Is he still around? He doesn't respond to my... I always respond to your emails, Mike. It's just, obviously, for some reason, it was lost in cyberspace, but, you know.
Oh, well, never mind.
Always a key place from that point of view. Now, yeah. I'll just do introductions here. We have our ace writer here, Abigail Tartalin. To get the whole thing sorted through there. Abigail, who's been talking about her latest text, Dead Girls, third novel, absolutely outstanding novel, and well worth accessing. If you're you know, at a loose end and you're in between rehearsals and various other bits and pieces, they get a copy of Dead Girls by Abigail Tartalin. It's well worth addressing.
Yeah. Sounds good.
But share with us this whole way and the phenomena in which After Midnight has developed and grown and actually become... It's more than a tribute band. I mean, I've been privileged to see you guys actually perform a few years ago, and... you kind of take Eric Clapton's wonderful work, but actually just add a bit more quality to it, if I'm not being heretical in terms of suggesting you could improve on Clapton's lines.
Well, I wouldn't say we add any quality to it, but we certainly try to do our version. It's not like an exact copy of Eric Clapton. We try to do our version. I would never claim to play as well as him, but I like to communicate with the audience and have a fun evening, and I think the audiences tend to appreciate that as well.
And that's part and parcel of the whole package. Now, share with us the kind of After Midnight has been going for quite some time, actually, Mike. And
33
English years.
Yes.
Talk us through how this fantastic band, which started in the 20th century, is still resonating solidly in the 21st.
Well, we started in 1985, I was watching Live Aid, and Eric Clapton was on that, and I thought, wow, after all these years, he's just as good as ever. And I used to play his music when I was in a band at school in the 60s, so I thought, right, I'm going to start a band playing Eric Clapton Cream-type music. So I put an ad in the newspaper, and I got a drummer, a bass player, and a keyboards player, just what I needed. And we formed a band, rehearsed for a few months, did our first show in December 1985, and we called the band After Midnight, after Eric's first solo record. And we've been going strong ever since.
And internationally as well, of course, because you were over in far-flung lands recently, I believe.
We've been all over the world, yeah. We played, last year we were in Sri Lanka. The year before, we did our second tour of India. And, we've played also in Estonia twice, Spain twice, Holland two or three times. It's just been brilliant. You know, it's fantastic to get paid to travel abroad and play this lovely music.
Exactly. So we're going to hear now, if that's okay, the full-length version of Layla. That's 5 minutes and 19 seconds of joy. Are you ready for this, Abigail?
I am indeed. I'm very excited.
Okay, it's the line that sort of is actually... Well, in which case, Mike, in your wonderful, inimitable stage presence, would you like to introduce this particular number, which, as I say, is pretty awesome in all sorts of ways? So, please, over to you, Mr. Hall.
Okay, well, this is After Midnight playing the full version of Eric's song Layla, and this was recorded in Newcastle around about 1987. So, what, nearly 30 years ago. So, yeah.
Danny Davison on drums, Paul Warren on keyboards and backing vocals, Dave Robson on bass and backing vocals, and Mike Hall, of course, on lead vocals and guitar. Abigail, what did you make of Layla as done by After Midnight?
Oh, well, I love that song anyway, but that end, that denouement was just fantastic. Mike, I really wanted to ask you a question, if I may.
Yes.
I just got back from India in January. I went to Kerala, and my favourite part of any trip is talking to the locals, and it's quite difficult to do, especially in a country where they see foreigners as you know, the people that it's almost like you're a different class. They're trying to serve you, and if you talk to them, they kind of back away. But I did manage to have some really good chats with some locals, and I was just wondering, I would assume that working somewhere like Sri Lanka really gives you more of an insight into just the people and what they think of where they live. Do you have any interesting tales from Sri Lanka? Or from any of your travels?
Well, I mean, Sri Lanka was a fantastic trip, and the gentleman who booked us there, he runs a chain of restaurants in Colombo. He's called Harpo. And I think he has 7 restaurants. And we were there for about 4 days, even though it was just one gig. And we had a meal in every one of his restaurants.
Wow.
And he was a fantastic guy. And he took quite a risk booking us. He laid out a lot of cash, paid for all the flights and everything. And the show was just amazing. The people really, you know, it felt like there was no language barrier or anything like that. And the people were so warm. I think probably the best thing about us playing abroad is meeting the local people, because they're just wonderful. You know, they're just pleased that you've made the effort to travel across those miles to see them, you know. And there's this kind of shared love of the music. I would go back to Sri Lanka at the drop of a hat. That was a wonderful place and wonderful people.
Fabulous.
Absolutely. Now, looking at some of the highlights, which, again, we keep saying we should really do a year in the life, a decade in the life of yourself, Mike, but past tours have included appearing at the Royal Festival Hall in 2002, the Glastonbury Festival, of course, also in 2002. In 2001, the Guitarist magazine actually featured the band, etc. You know, Estonia, Spain, Madrid, the Acoustic Festival of Britain. It's never-ending, really, in many ways, the sort of line from that. Did you ever, 33 years ago, sort of think, yeah, we'll be talking about this on radio stations and doing it well into the 21st century?
Oh, yeah. No, to be honest, every band I'd been in before After Midnight had lasted no more than a few months. And when I formed it, just the thought of a long-lasting band wasn't even in my mind, because I'd never been in a band that had lasted that long. And it just kind of snowballed locally, you know, around the northeast, and then around about 2000, when the tribute band phenomenon happened, you know, and it just seemed, well, we may as well be playing theatres all over the country, and it just kind of snowballed from there. So I'd never dreamt it would last more than 6 months or a year, really, and here we are, 33 years later.
And one day, I'm sure you'll make it to Lincoln as well. But don't worry, because at least you're in Middlesbrough,
which
is good. Middlesbrough Theatre on the 25th of May. Now, are tickets still available, Mike? Is it possible?
Yes, there's still plenty of tickets available.
Oh, this is good, because usually snapped up extraordinarily well from that point of view. And as we also pointed out in times past, Paul Warren was actually born in Middlesbrough, now lives in Darlington, which is wonderful. There's a local connection there. Which
local
is,
guy,
marvellous. It's been awesome as ever, Mike, and I feel as though it's been far too long since we last actually featured your good self.
Yes.
It's probably been a couple of years or so. So, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the programme today?
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. It's great to speak to you again, Alex.
Marvellous.
And Abigail, yes.
There we are. Well, I'm sure we'll try and get and see you in the not-too-distant future as well. Will you return to the programme as well?
Yes, anytime. Always welcome.
That's what we'd like to hear. Up next, we're going to have a young lady who's probably never actually heard of Eric Clapton. No, I might be sort of doing her disservice. That's Kira Alsbrook. She's going to be connecting with us from Derbyshire, amongst other things. Mike, quick plug for the social networks and the media. How can people actually follow Classic Clapton, apart from going to classic-clapton.com?
Well, there's that one, yeah. And then there's our Facebook page, which is just, it's Facebook / Classic Clapton, And we're also on Twitter, and it's at Classic Clapton.
Well, there we are. Yeah. One thing, of course, you need to get on Instagram as well, just to cover all the bases on that.
Well, I suppose so, yeah.
Sounds very savvy, though, with Classic Clapton on everything.
See, exactly.
I'm much more difficult to find with my ridiculously spelled name.
It'll all work out perfectly, Abigail Tartlin. It's important. Mike, we salute you. Take care, and we'll speak again very soon. Cheers, Dan.
Thanks very much, Alex. Bye-bye.
Bye, Mike.
Bye, Abigail. Bye.
And just in case you're wondering, we are listening to Siren Radio, and this is Alicia Keys, and she's on fire.
Hotter than a fantasy, lonely like a highway. She's living in a world and it's on fire. Filled with catastrophe, but she knows she can fly away.